Blog Talk Radio.
Stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. It once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Good evening, and welcome to the Stop Child Abuse Now show on the Blog Talk Radio Network, sponsored by the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Bill Murray. I'm coming to you from Los Angeles tonight, and I am myself an adult survivor of child abuse. Tonight we have a returning special guest, a returning family member, Michael Skinner, who those of you who have been listening to the show for a while will know well, and many of you who are activists in the world of child abuse prevention and intervention and recovery from child abuse will also know Michael. He's one of our favorite guests, and we haven't had him for a while. We've been remiss, and we're delighted to be able to have this opportunity to catch up with him. His organization out of New Hampshire, it's where he is called Surviving Spirit, and we're going to talk a lot about Surviving Spirit, its newsletter, its programs, and so forth, and the fact that Michael Skinner is a musician, and his work can be found on YouTube. We'll tell you how to find that, too. Michael Skinner is going to spend the entire 90 minutes with us, and before I get to him, and I see he's there, hopefully he's got his feet up in our green room. we will let you know that we have our chat room open now, and we will have a panelist of people who will help me do tonight's show, who I'll introduce first, and then we'll bring Michael right along. The first one I want to introduce is Carol Levine from New Jersey. Carol D. Levine is the author of Panic Child, the harrowing true story of sexual abuse and neglect, which she wrote as an autobiographical work. It describes the horrors of her childhood, which were multiple, how it affected her adulthood. And the most important part of the book is the beginning of her recovery is described, a recovery that's now lasted over 30 years. And we're very grateful to have Carol with us each night. She's very active in her own Northeast New Jersey and Northwest New Jersey and Northeast Pennsylvania, and she's the co-host of the Monday to Friday shows. Carol, thanks for being here tonight.
Always happy to be here, and looking forward to our guest.
Good. All right. Second up on our panel tonight is from across the pond in Ireland. She calls in at 1 o'clock in the morning her time in order to make these shows live our time. Her name is Lurline Thilliard. Lurline is herself a victim of domestic violence, but her four boys all experienced child abuse at the hands of their own dad, and she's very passionate now and very involved with the organization that we represent, NASCA. She does a lot of work with us on Facebook and LinkedIn and other social networking, basically outreach-type work. And in addition to that, she helps me coordinate the special guests, such as Michael, and schedule them when they come on the Monday to Friday shows. Lurline Thilliard is a regular panelist now, along with everything else, and we're always very happy to have her included in our show. So, Lurline, thank you very much for being here with us.
I'm very happy to be here. I'm looking forward to the show with Michael.
Good. All right. Our final panelist for tonight. No, there's going to be two more. Okay. It is MJ Goings. MJ Goings is from Ohio, and she is the sole member of the panel tonight who's not an abused person, but she is a very dedicated volunteer with both NASCA and its predecessor and sister site, LA Community Policing. MJ is by trade a registered nurse. She works as a shift supervisor at the Rural County Hospital where she lives in Ohio. And she's a regular contributor to our effort because she does the majority of the research that goes into the daily news that we provide on both websites. We're always therefore grateful to have her as a participant on our show as well. NJ Goings, good evening. How are you?
Hello, Bill. Hi, everyone.
All right. And our final panelist, I didn't expect him to be here, but I'm glad he is Ed Mashick. Ed Mashick is calling from the Orlando, Florida area, where he now resides. He grew up in foster care, mostly in Nebraska, and he did not have a good experience there. But he's been in recovery a little while now, and he's been very dedicated to doing whatever he can to alleviate some of the pain in the community that he lives. And, you know, he's working on himself as well. Ed Mashick, as I say, calls in not as often as we'd like, but a couple times a week is great if he can afford it. And he was here with us last night and here again tonight. So let's welcome to the show Ed Mashick. Hi, Ed. How are you tonight?
I'm good, Bill. Good to be here.
Thanks for calling in. All right, let's get to our guest now. As I said, everybody who is an activist in the field of child abuse, or many, many of us, will already know who Michael Skinner is, and he's been a member of the NASCA family virtually since we began doing these shows. He's one of the earlier of our guests. We have been remiss at not having him back since then, and we don't want to wait that long again. We're going to have to insist that our special guests and family members like Michael understand that we want them to interact with us so that we can find out when there are things that need to be updated about the work that they're doing. Plus, it's always possible for them to ask for us to designate a show, because we do six shows a week, and it's always possible for us to take one of the shows that we have that are called open topic shows and make it a topic of a guest's choice, a family member's choice. If they have an issue they want to spend a show talking about, they can simply ask us ahead of time. We'll be happy to make that happen. In any case, Michael Skinner is one of those people that we'd always be delighted to engage with. He's from New Hampshire, and we're going to find out a lot about what Michael's been into in the last couple of years, really. Michael Skinner from New Hampshire, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
We spent a lot of time on the last time you appeared talking about your music, and we want people to know that you are a musician, and a lot of the themes of your music have to do with the abuse or the recovery that you yourself experience, or from the perspective of a child. And they should go to the YouTube channel, NCSTRAIN, McStrain, to hear Michael's music, and that's part of the description of tonight's show. However, we're not going to spend as much time talking about the music, because there's so many other aspects, as I said to you on a call earlier today, of what you do that are important, and I feel like perhaps we didn't give enough emphasis on some of that last time. Besides which, you've been developing it ever since, and I'm speaking specifically of another thing that's linked in the website, in the web description of the tonight's show, Surviving Spirit, at survivingspirit.com. You consider that the core, where everybody can go, and that's sort of the core place people can find out information about you, Michael, in your group?
Yeah, it is. And then my own website, which I've been remiss, it needs to be updated, but, you know, the Surviving Spirit website, as well as my own site, can, you know, give folks a lot of background on me, but the Surviving Spirit site will definitely give you the ideas of what and how that came about, because there's a lot of content on there that, you know, so if you like to read, there's plenty to read.
Exactly. And there's also a newsletter that goes out monthly. If you get on the newsletter list, you'll never miss at least numerous of the topics that Michael follows and other people that write to him offer him. And the Surviving Spirit newsletter just comes automatically if you sign for it on the website. Now, you say your own site. What's the web address of that, Michael?
It's www.mskinnermusic.com.
Okay. mskinnermusic.com. All right, we'll try to remember to announce that a couple of times during tonight's show as well. But in any case, Michael Skinner, you are a survivor yourself, and we do ask our survivor guests to tell some version of their story. It can be, you know, with as much or as little detail as you wish, and feel comfortable to use adult language if you want, because we're an adult show. But if you would just spend a little bit of time so the public can hear, you know, kind of your background, and then maybe identify with some of the things that you're going to say. Tell us what it was like growing up, little Michael.
Well, it was horrible. It was a nightmare. and I don't say that lightly. I grew up, I was born in Boston, Massachusetts, and lived there and in the city of Cambridge till the age of six, and then moved up to Billerica, Massachusetts, which is about 18 miles outside of the city, a little suburb. And I was the oldest of five siblings, and just so you know how our growing up was no picnic, two of my brothers have committed suicide, so it was rough. It was both parents. They were both brutal. They were sadistic. They were perverse. There was emotional abuse, physical. There was neglect. And then the unfortunate, the sexual abuse. It was all rolled into one. And they also, at times, because they had friends who did the same thing. And I don't remember all the details, but I know I've long said how I was passed around like cheese fondue, so they had no problems passing you around to other adults and making you do things to other children, and children do things to you, and also to adults. And this went on for a really long time. So since as long as I've had memory, right up until my teen years, until I was old enough and strong enough to stop them, but Betty, I don't like calling her my mother, but she was, I think that was about 14, maybe 15, where I finally got her to stop. I just told her, she couldn't touch me anymore. With Dick, my father, unfortunately, I told him also, but he beat the living hell out of me, and then proceeded to rape me, let me know that he was still in charge. So after that, it was like 15 or 16 years old, I told him if he touched me again, and, as you said, these are adults on this show. I told him I'd kill him, that I was going to slice his throat and drive a knife through his heart. And so from that point on, I was carrying knives to protect myself. That's how I got it to stop. So it was a nightmare. We lived in a little working-class, middle-class neighborhood, and, because right across the street from me was, the fire chief. Diagonally across was a police lieutenant. Up the street was a building contractor. There was plasterer, electricians, engineers. So it was your typical
working class
neighborhood.
Yeah.
So, but it was anything but a working class, middle class upbringing, because it was actually a nightmare. There was, so he made money. He was a big man because he did plumbing and those types of things, and he worked for a very large company down in Cambridge. Taking care of the plumbing, the electrical, and maintenance, very large real estate firm, which they had the most holdings after Harvard University. So they were quite large. They owned all those brownstone buildings and things. But he also did some work, and I first heard of this because I remember, my mother telling me, how he used to go collect money from people who owed gambling debts or. It was loan sharking, mm-hmm. So he was the one that would put the fear into you or hurt you. Mm-hmm. I can remember as a child, him calling me out, and it was either 7 or 8, maybe I was 9. But him showing me a wound in his leg, and as any kid, in shock, well, what is that? And he was bragging how someone had, he had beaten him up and put him down because they owed money. It was only bits and my memory, because I deal with dissociation, so I just have bits and pieces of memory of the things.
Okay, sure.
He told me how he beat this guy up, threw him down, had his foot on his chest, and the guy, stuck him with a knife. And then as a kid, I asked him, well, what'd you do next? And what'd you do? And he told me how he shoved the knife so far up his, I won't swear, he'll never stab anyone again. And as a child, I kept thinking he just told me he killed someone. So,
right.
that's part of my background. So
mm-hmm.
It was not.
I wouldn't call it your typical nurturing background, or the one we hope for many children. Now, Michael, you grew up in a family with, I think you said, 8 kids in it. And
five.
I'm wondering.
Five.
Oh, okay, five. I'm wondering if. The abuse that you're describing was kind of evenly dispersed among the five, or did they pick some of you out and not the others, or how did that work in your family?
To the best of my memory, it was going on to all of us. I know I was a scapegoat, as well as my brother Wayne, who was in the middle, and I think one because we stood up to them. And then also, my parents, you know, they let me know how they were very angry at me because I was, you know, born out of wedlock and how I ruined their lives. I heard this over and over again, you know, and how I ruined her, you know, she could have gone to New York City and sang on Broadway because she did have, she had a beautiful voice. She truly did, but she could have done all these things. But, you know, but of course, I'm not the one that made them have sex.
Of course not.
And so I was always being blamed for that. And there was something that was, it was kind of funny, but not funny when you, he always kept, you know, remarking how I was, you know, I was at the wedding. And I'd look at their wedding pictures and I was trying to see me, but, you know, but basically because I was in, you know, my mother's stomach, that's, but he just thought that was funny. So for all those years I was looking to, I had no idea what conception. And so, you know, as a little boy, I'm looking in the picture, you know, I'm trying to find me and I didn't see me, but, so they, you know, but part of what made a bad situation worse, Bill, with this was they were sadistic and they were brutal. And when I say evil, I don't mean it in the sense of religious overtones or a devil with a pitchfork or any of that. They did this with intent, and you can, you know it when you see it in someone's eyes, and that was very disturbing to see that they enjoyed hurting you. It was, you know, trying to break the spirit of a child, and that,
yes,
and the things that they did. That was, I still, for me to this day, I still think that is really made my healing journey that much harder because of the evil intent. Because it's, you know, any type of abuse and it's horrible, but when it's done with intent, it was, you know, because I've long thought, you know, I see a picture of Saddam Hussein, you know, I think of my father because Saddam Hussein was a big guy, had that same stupid mustache. You know, they look similar in a way because they're both big, and, you know, and her, you know, she was decked to the nines, very attractive, you know, outstanding member of the local church, sang in the choir. So I don't have much use for religious zealots either because she brought me to a church where there were things being done too. So, and I don't paint all churches or all people of their faith with that, but I just, this hypocrisy that just, you know, and this was a congregational church, so this wasn't a Catholic church. So,
well, we'll come back to some of these things you're talking about, Michael, in a second. I want to get the panel to welcome you to the show. I do want to say that it's a shame when you have a police chief across, you know, a captain across the street and a fire chief and, you know, and some other, that, you know, things that the abuse that was going on right under their nose wasn't, if it was noticed, certainly wasn't dealt with, and you didn't get the help that was obviously needed at the time. We'll return to that theme, too, because this is an experience that a lot of children have had, and some of these are really universal. Some of them are unique to you, and just as I go to Carol first, since she's the co-host of the show, I usually go to her first, I will mention to you that I agree with you. There are some people who just are evil, you know, at their core. They have an evil spirit about them. They are evil spirits, and perhaps both of your parents were cut from that mold. But I guarantee there are evil people in the world. So let's get Carol to say hi to you. Carol Levine from New Jersey. Please say hi to Michael Skinner from New Hampshire.
Hi, Michael. Glad you're back.
Hi, Carol.
Yeah. You know, I know what you're talking about. When you say your parents knew exactly how they were treating you and they didn't care. In fact, they were trying to, hurt you even more, you know. And I think that digs deeper. It digs deeper than any part of abuses that we can go through. Because when those who are supposed to nurture you are your abusers and they have this weird, twisted look on their face, because I had that in my family as well, that cuts to the core, okay? That just, you know, cuts you to the core. It just hurts so bad. And that's very hard to heal from.
Yeah. I agree.
Yes. And I understand why you use your music. I use my music, too, you know, to take my emotions and my feelings out and so forth. I come from a musical background, too.
And, do you play?
Well, I played the piano, but I'm a singer. You know, I sing a lot. I like to sing better. I like to play the piano, but I took a lot of my emotions out on the piano, and sometimes I was in bad humor. I took it out on the piano, and, you know, I understand where you're coming from. I'm sorry you went through all of that, and we're really happy to have you back.
Thanks.
we discovered, Michael, that a number of us have musical backgrounds. I do as well. MJ does as well. I think perhaps a couple of our other members do as well. And we decided we were going to, someday we were going to do a recovery band or something together if we could ever actually meet.
Before the road.
Yeah. Well, I'm ready. And I'm a singer, too, and I'm a guitar player. I play bass and guitar and stuff, too. So we got plenty of instruments. MJ Goins is a pianist. I'm going to get to her, not next, but the one after. But let me first introduce you to Lurleen Hilliard, who you've met by email now several times, but not heard her voice. And, of course, she speaks with the Irish Brogue from Dublin. Lurleen, please say hi to Michael for me.
It's my pleasure. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
It's lovely. Hi. I'm so sorry that you lost four siblings through suicide. I mean, on top of the abuse to have to deal with that, that must be so traumatic. And I'm sorry that you have. Your parents, they sounded just like they were just evil. They were, you didn't have one evil parent, you had two. And so many children, if they're being abused by one parent, they possibly have the escape or the protection of another one in some ways, but you have neither. And just to have come as far as you have and to do everything that you're doing, it says a huge amount about you. So I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of your story because I haven't heard it before.
Well, thank you.
Lurleen's boys, all four boys, were abused at the hands of their father, who she's divorced now, but she's still, she's kind of new to the concept of recovery, but very dedicated to the NASCAP. And, of course, we're very inclusive, as you know, Michael, with all types of child abuse being included, be it sexual, violent, emotional, or through neglect. We want people to know that recovery is possible and that prevention is possible and intervention is possible. All those, these are all topics we could possibly discuss and touch on tonight, but that's what NASCAP is all about. And Lurleen is very dedicated and passionate in trying to help other people avoid the pain she and her family have been through. MJ Goins is the sole member of our panel tonight who is not either being abused in childhood or really in adulthood, at least not as bad as some others. She's from rural Ohio and is a very dedicated volunteer with us. She works every day helping me update every morning the two websites with the daily news of the day. And then she's also a panelist multiple times a week. MJ, please say hi to Michael.
Hi, Michael. It's great to have you back again. It's been a long time, too long.
Hello.
I thought of something that you said when you talked about your parents blaming you and how common. We've heard that so many times. The victim blamed because you said something that enticed me. You looked at me a certain way. You acted like you wanted it. And in your case, you weren't even created yet, but it was certainly your fault.
Twisted.
Exactly, twisted, come up with any reason to take the blame away from themselves and put it on the kids. But good to have you back again.
Thank you.
And, of course, we also, MJ will verify this, we also hear so many times that the children of abuse, only one of who out of every 10 will get their abuse recognized while they're still young, get into some kind of recovery position when they're still young services. So 9 out of 10 of us share the common characteristic of bringing kind of an untreated case of childhood trauma into our adulthood most of the time as the big secret of our life, that we are determined to keep, some of us, till the rest of our life, and many of us for decades and decades until we even hear the message that recovery is possible. Well, one of the things we hear, another thing that we hear in common is this sense of shame or guilt or somehow having been wrong ourselves. And of course, children are not responsible for what happens to them when they're young. It's always the adult that's responsible, no matter what. Yet we get this message sometimes overtly told us, like, if it weren't for you, I wouldn't have done such and such a thing. You have only yourself to blame kind of message, and we accept that as children. And sometimes it's just because we know we're in our parents' way, and how is that our fault? And yet we buy into that, and it's one of the kind of characteristics, the set of the shame and the guilt and the feeling of responsibility that many adult survivors are still feeling. And we need to tell them it was never your fault and it never will be your fault, whatever happened to you when you were a child. it's always the adult who has all the power and authority in these situations, and it's always their responsibility. All right, let's get Ed included. I'm delighted to have Ed on the show tonight. Ed doesn't call in as often as we'd like, but when he's here, I'm delighted to have him. He's calling in from the Orlando, Florida area, although he grew up in foster care in Nebraska, and he had a terrible foster care experience with multiple parents, actually, multiple situations. I'm trying to get his microphone to open for me, and it's not behaving. Here we go. Come on.
Yeah, I got you.
Okay, now you're open. Ed, please say hi to Michael for me.
Hi, Michael. Good to have you back.
Hello, Ed.
Pretty sure I remember the last time you were on, and you know, it goes without saying, but I can really relate to what you're talking about. My father beat the hell out of us, but I still believe he did it because he was as afraid of his wife as we were, you know. But you know, you can tell the difference between somebody who's beating you because they just don't know any better, ignorance, and those who like do it out of pleasure. And there's something about looking at your mother's face while she's beating you and knowing that she's enjoying it that just, you know, etches itself on your brain.
I agree. It leaves an imprint upon your soul, Barrett.
Yeah. Good to have you here. I understand.
Yeah. Well, let's also say, Ed, before you leave, that, you know, every adult in the family is responsible. It's not just the one that's doing the beating. Sometimes there's one adult who's the sexually active one and the other is a bystander. But they're culpable just as much as the one that's doing the assault if they don't take steps to protect the child, too, because all adults are responsible for all children. Now, I just want to make sure people understand that it doesn't have to be both adults who are doing it in order for both adults to be guilty of participating in the child abuse that's going on under their own roofs.
I'm not trying to minimize my father's involvement.
No, I knew
he was
that.
Extremely physically abusive himself, and he was just as catamount in covering up the sexual abuse as my mother was, even though, you know, she kept it from him for about 8 years. I hate him for a different reason than I hate her. You know,
okay.
You could
okay.
see that she actually enjoyed what she did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Some extra things that I didn't expect to come up with. Michael, we can go off on any of these tangents, obviously, as the show goes on. But as you can see, a lot of us identify with your story, and especially with the hopelessness of being a child and then, you know, be the confusion in adulthood about, you know, why this happened to us and what it meant to us. And then, as I said, most of us do begin our adulthood trying to keep it a secret because we feel defective and unacceptable and unloved, and of course we're in pain or we're angry, we have a lot of fear, we're sad, and lots of different emotional states. What was it like as you made the transition out of your family, Michael, and into your adolescence or early adulthood, and how smoothly did that go?
How smoothly did that go?
Yeah, I thought I'd throw in a word like that. Yeah.
It's like following the yellow brick road in the land of Oz. question, Bill. Can you hear me okay? Because I put it on speakerphone. Is that okay?
Yes, you're coming through fine. Very good.
All right. Well, how I made it through adolescence, because we're talking about music, and when I say this, I mean it with all sincerity. I don't throw it out haphazardly. That it literally saved my life, not only just listening to it, but then discovering that, you know, I could play the drums. So I started teaching myself and learning how to play the drums at the age of 10. By the time I was 12 years old, playing in the local neighborhood band, and we were playing at teen centers and parties and getting paid for it, and that soon led to junior high dances, high school dances. So throughout my teenage years, that's what we were doing. By the time I was 15 and 16, we were a really good band. We were winning Battle of the Band, so that was keeping me active. We were playing dances. We were playing in nightclubs. So when I graduated from school, that led right into playing 5 and 6 nights a week in nightclubs. And then, as I like to say, I would be pounding nails during the day or doing plumbing on pools. But, you know, I was a professional musician. And then I did that I did that all my life as a, you know, a drummer, and that's how I made a living for most of my life. But there was a, it wasn't smooth also because there was this part of me that was just confused. And as a teenager, I drank too much. I'm not an alcoholic, thank goodness for that, because I can still have a beer, and that's all I'll have, you know, for 2 or 3 weeks. But as a young man, I drank too much, meaning, you know, the teenage years. I was in a lot of fights. It was just so much rage. I can look back now, and now I know why. I went into all the wrong bars and all the wrong places. Any time I saw something I thought was any sense of bully or whatever, it was an excuse for me to want to, you know, pound them. So it was just this strange thing, you know, the promiscuity, all the rest of it. It was just a real strange mix. It was confusing to me. It was very confusing. So it was not a smooth life, if you will. I was working. People liked me. I had, you know, friends, girlfriends, stuff. But there was this part of me that just felt horrible inside. I couldn't stay close to anyone because I was always worried if they ever found out what truly went on with me as a child, that, you know, they'd just think I was some pervert, even though I wasn't the one that did it. So that was hard and confusing. Thankfully, though, with music, I kept busy, and I was a workaholic. I got to tour overseas in Great Britain for 2 years with the hard rock band American Trains, and that was the first time at the age of 21 that I felt truly safe because I had a whole ocean protecting me from my family of origin. So and at that point, my girlfriend became pregnant, but something that really, the music, being over Great Britain, playing all the time, you know, the band was doing great, you know, it was our own songs. We were doing really well. We were doing the same gigs back then, this is in 76 and 77, as AC/DC was. We were being touted as the next thing to take over from Deep Purple, all this. So, you know, in that respect, life was good, but I was still torn and confused. But a magical thing that happened for me that helped me on turning my life around and really get going with healing was the birth of my first daughter, and I was 21, and just holding her, it just, I don't know, that was one of those transformative moments. I just realized that I had something to live for now, because up until that point, I didn't feel I had anything to live for. And I think a lot of the situations I put myself in, probably like a death wish, if you will, so that helped me to slow down. I still had a lot of growing up and buckling down to do, but that was a pivotal point in my life. So
you were lucky to. Yeah, that was great, though, that you had it that early at the 21, I'll be honest with you. I didn't have it till 37. I didn't have my first and only child till 37. And I understand what you're saying about how that's a centering kind of experience. It gives you a sense of, you know, direction and purpose and so forth. But I know your life didn't go, it still wasn't a straight arrow past 21. That's not what you're trying to say. You're just trying to say you have a daughter you love.
Yeah, well, but what helped with that, Bill, was, you know, people talk about, you know, and you'd have a girlfriend and they're telling you that I love you and all, but it just, to me, it was just phony, because I didn't believe anybody. I didn't believe in love because of my childhood. I was dark to that. I could get close to someone, but I didn't believe in love. My daughter, then the rest of my daughters, they taught me how to love. So that was huge for me, and I'll never forget that. It really helped turn my life around. But as we just shared, I still had a lot more still to endure and go through and to grow. It certainly wasn't over.
And this is a very common experience as well with abusive and trauma survivors, that we don't have a pattern, you know, presented to us in our own childhood of what it is to be healthy, you know, how to make good choices, how to have good relationships, pick friends, select careers, you know, learn how to live. And an awful lot of us on top of that are, since we have all these feelings that I talked about before, the ones about fear and shame and not feeling good enough and never fitting in, we choose, you know, paths that are abusive in terms of addictive or obsessive behaviors. Many of us do pick, you know, turning to drugs and alcohol because they change how we feel about ourselves. We hate how we feel about ourselves. And at least that alters, it's almost like a medicine, you know, for us. But if it's not that, it could be, gambling. It could be cutting. It could be overeating. It could be doing what we call geographics, which is moving from one side of the country to the other and back and forth, trying to get away from ourselves, you know. And there's lots of different paths that are destructive, is the point, that we have, you know, we have a common experience of being confused, and we're, and a more of a likelihood that we will select at least some of these paths as feeling appropriate at the time. And of course, we find out later that they're an additional problem that we, you know, sometimes we have to deal with the new problem, at the same time we hear, or even before we hear the message that recovery from our trauma, which most of us still need to hear, you know, is a possibility, because that's the root problem of our life. It's the earliest problem of our life, and it's the thing that set us up for, it's kind of like the foundation. Like you say, you didn't have any foundation except one of trauma. You didn't know what a relationship was like, or life was like, or love was. Of course not.
It's such a slow learning curve. My drug of choice, I never did illegal drugs, even being in the musician and in the music business pretty much all my life. I'm grateful for that, but my drug of choice was being a workaholic, and that wasn't healthy. So, but back then, my way of staying busy, and as you talked about geographically, well, it was great because I could be touring all the time, or I was in the business end of it, same thing. I could just be all over the place, just driving.
Right.
And, yes, I'm married, and I have kids, or I have friends, but I couldn't get close to people. Every time I'd start to get, you know, okay, I got to go off to here. So it was a perfect excuse. Of course, I didn't know it at the time. Now I can look back in hindsight, and I was just running.
Right.
I wish I knew
running
that. Part of why what we do today, you know, self and the fellow hosts on the show, and what I do is, when we share our story, is to say, hey, you know, this is where we went awry with this, where mistakes were made, because we just didn't know. So, man, if we can reach someone else, whether they're younger or older or whatever, to help lay some of that, to just get on a different path than the one we did.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we're trying to help them break the pattern that they may have found themselves in, just as we've, hopefully, we're in the process of breaking our own, you know, our own pattern, creating our own destiny now based on new information. Let's go to Carol for the next comment. Carol, comment or question for Michael?
Well, you know, Michael, we've been down the same roads, okay, the same streets, and you may say you were a workaholic, and I'm sure you were, but I wasn't a workaholic. I was an alcoholic, drug addict, thought of suicide. I was suicidal ideations out on the streets. All the places I shouldn't have been and things I shouldn't have done, okay? I have to take some, you know, I knew what I was doing half the time, and I didn't care because nobody else did, okay? But then all of a sudden I realized that I was really on the wrong path, and I couldn't drink anymore because my body was like saying, hey, you better stop, otherwise you're going to die, because my fingers bloated and my kidneys pounded, but my life hadn't changed. So I was really all screwed up. I just didn't know what to do with myself, you know? And but I have to say that my church group did help me. That's one good church group, okay? I didn't have any family. I grew up on the streets mostly. And a church group got a hold of me, and they straightened my life out. There are some good churches, not nearly as many as there used to be, I don't think. But there are some good churches, and that's what brought me around. So now, you know, in the last, I don't know, last 15 years, I guess, I've really started to heal. You know, it took me a long time. Because I hated myself. After all, I was a person not of worth. I didn't know how to pick friends, didn't know how to pick partners. All that goes along with it. And I felt numb as a kid. I had no feeling, okay? And if I did start to feel, then I'd drink, because who wanted to feel? And as far as love is concerned, yeah, same thing. When I had my children, I learned love from my children because I loved them so. You know, I just learned how to love them. It was just one of the greatest things that ever happened to me, I think, was to have my children. So I can identify with that, too.
Yeah, I agree. I hear you on that. I agree with that.
I should say, Michael, I didn't touch on it, but Carol did, that the overworking, or the becoming a workaholic, or the perfectionist, or the person that never makes a ripple, and is a goody-two-shoes, maybe some of us are like that, those are also obsessions, and they're all part of the same, you know, attempt at finding a solution for not knowing how life works. You know, we don't know how to be human, you know, and so we obsess and we go in one direction or another, or multiple of them, you know, trying to seek out you know, fixing, putting a Band-Aid on, you know, on who we are. And if you're an obsessive worker or if you're a perfectionist, you know, who is disappointed with him or herself because you make a single mistake, you know, you're setting yourself up for a life of disappointment because we're all going to make mistakes. You know, we're all human.
I grew up in the house of perfection, so yes, I learned that early, sadly.
Exactly. All right,
and
let's
just
get
so quickly, just
yeah,
so you, I was talking about
go
the
ahead.
Church.
Yeah.
I railed against the hypocrisy of some and the phoniness, but please know, I have some really good friends who are priests, who are pastors, and many of whom are on our newsletter list, so I don't bash all. It's just there's certain ones I have a hard time with.
No, and she understood that, and so do I. You know, you may not recall this, but a lot of my molesters were priests and brothers, and there were multiple of them over a many-year period of time. And one of the things I found out was that, you know, I wasn't so much angry at the church or at all priests as I was at certain pedophiles who happened to be priests. There's a big difference. And that's true of congregations, too. There are some who are really self-centered and interested only in their own message. If I'm asked to select a group that I'm going to, admire, it'll be somebody that's much more ecumenical than that, someone who allows for the possibility of different kinds of definition of God and recovery and heaven and all those things. So, you know, but many of us do have, and I do too, at least a spiritual element in our recovery. In my case, I recovered through a 12-step process, which many will recognize as being a spiritual path. All right, let's get Lurleen to make some comments or questions. You're back on, Lurleen.
Thanks, Bill. I didn't live a life of child abuse, as Bill said, Mike, but my children did. And I can relate a lot of what you said to them, your hatred for your father, how you told him you'd kill him. One of mine, I think he told his father that he would skin him alive with a spoon, and that was how much he hated him. And he still does to this day. But I think with your music, that it's a wonderful thing because you have put your passion, your trauma, your upset, everything you suffered into your music. And that's why you've been so successful, because it's true to you. What you sing, what you play about is actually how you feel. And I think at least you have that one outlet where so many don't have it. I mean, you know, people hold in their frustrations, they, you know, they abuse others, they get into violence, drugs, whatever, but you have your music, and I think that is a gift that you were given from your abuse.
Thank you. I agree. It is a gift, and I'm grateful, and as I say to folks, you know, learn if you can to play an instrument, anything, the creative arts, to help you in your healing journey. You don't have to do it professionally, because even before, you know, I called in for the show, half hour ago, I was playing my guitar just to help ground me and just doing some songs. So yes, music and all the creative arts are so good for us.
Yeah, I agree. My family did not recognize that I had any kind of musical or creative talents, and I was reaching them. I don't know how they didn't get it, but being adopted, they didn't identify with it, so they didn't encourage it. In fact, they discouraged it, and they thought of, you know, music as being okay, or any of the arts as okay for hobbies, but not as a career path. And so I had to wait to self-teach myself music. And I, too, was a drummer early on. But the one instrument that I came with was a voice. And so I sang at every opportunity, everything, didn't matter what it was. You know, I didn't care if it was Christmas carols to classical music to folk songs to rock and roll to, you know, did not matter to me. If there was a voice involved, I wanted my, and that was part of my saving grace too. And eventually, I taught myself guitar, but that wasn't until I was in college. You know, when I finally got away and on my own, and I really taught myself by way of being able to accompany my voice, I guess. But anyway, music is a very it's a path of in itself. You know, you can lose you. I'm sure you identify with losing yourself in the music, you know, and if you play a set on stage and you get down and you're like, wow, it went by so fast. I had no sense of time. I just, you know, your time evaporates or stand still, maybe is a better way to put it sometimes when you're really involved in listening to the music you're creating yourself.
and enjoy the wonder of
it
hearing other musicians. Because I also get excited and get lost, as you were just saying, listening to other musicians, whether it's a solo guitar player, pianist, or a band. As we're talking about music, I'm going back to being a young boy because, I'm 59, so Petula Clark singing Downtown. I used to listen to that, and I swear she was singing to me.
I remember. I'm a year older, so we're the same, same musical age. And I played, music on the streets of New York in pickup bands, and then in a bluegrass group, for God's sake, in Manhattan. Because at that time I played upright bass, and I used to lug my bass on the subway to the next gig.
Well, let's do this band again. I want to hear you sing. So we're going to go on the road here. Find a foundation to fund us.
Okay, we'll get to that as soon as we can, and I'm all for it. Let's get MJ's opinion about music and whatever else she wants to talk about, too, and remembering that she herself is a pianist and taught by music teachers taught you, right, MJ?
Right, right. I was thinking about this band going on the road. I wrote in the chat room, I think maybe we'd have to try to be sponsored by AARP. But
that sounds good.
I love it.
Works for me.
No, I actually was thinking that, Mike, this segment, you proved a point from something we talked about last segment. I brought up the fact that the victims are always blamed. And you proved that a child can come out of a horrible situation. You didn't know what love was growing up. You knew pain. You knew torture. You knew essentially rejection. And as soon as your child was born, you knew how to love. And that proves that for a parent to love a child is not learned. It's innate. So the people that don't have that innate quality are the ones that have something wrong with them. It's not the victims.
Mm-hmm.
It's the perpetrators, always.
Mm-hmm.
I agree. Well, I've come to believe that both of my parents were sociopaths. I didn't have the verbiage. I didn't have the knowledge of what a sociopath was when I was a kid or even a teenager, even a young man, but as time has gone on and, my healing and just learning as much as I can, I something was definitely awry with the two of them.
Right.
Well, I like this idea of being sponsored by AARP and going on the road. I know we have the last member of our panel. I don't know if he's a musician or not, but he would make like the perfect roadie security guy because he's a big, huge guy and you don't mess with him. Ed, you're welcome along. I don't know if you play an instrument or not, but we could use you. We'll take advantage of you.
I grew up playing brass instruments, and I sang in a barbershop choir for about 15 years.
There you go.
I am musically inclined. I actually still write lyrics. I don't know how to write music, but I would love for somebody to put what I write to music.
Sure.
I believe there would be something incredibly, incredibly therapeutic about hearing someone else sing my lyrics.
I love collaborating and co-writing. Don't be shy.
I'd be happy to do that. Of course, 90% of what I write is very cause-driven. It has to deal with all of this kind of stuff. And I do recite some of it at open poetry nights or at slam nights. And, my reactions are always very, very mixed. I've had people in tears, and I've had people scared to make eye contact with me. It's for a cause. It's great. The thing is, I like, like 80s rock, classical music, blues, but the way my stuff comes out, as I write it, the beats that are going on in my head, most of my stuff I picture being done as either rap or heavy metal, even though I don't really listen to that kind of music a lot. I think that it's just the tone of what I write about. I think it would be, art is something very personal. And, music and writing and painting is all forms of art. And art comes from our soul. I believe that. And art is very personal. It's an extension of who we are. And hearing that recited for people like Mike, I can only imagine where he'd be today without music.
Exactly.
You know, and so I just, I do write a lot, and I've made the offer to many people. I know different people have different ways of making music. Some people write lyrics and then come up with the music, and some people write music and then try and put lyrics to it. And, you know, I've offered the musicians I know to do that, to, you know, you write a song, you don't have lyrics for it, send it to me, tell me the theme or the idea, and I'll write. I'll come up with your lyrics for you. And as yet, I haven't been able to take me up on the offer.
Sometimes the lyrics come first, Ed. It can be done both ways, and it can be done in a group too. So it's not a matter. Sometimes it's the cart before the horse, the way you're thinking.
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't have to be music, and then write lyrics for the music. It can be the other way around too. Go ahead, Michael. Sorry.
No. Go ahead. Send me some lyrics. I'd love to see what you've done, and if I can put music to it, great. I know I can.
All right.
I've done it before with others.
Sure,
I'd be happy to.
I'd love to participate in anything like this. And somebody just suggested a band name in the chat room. Let me see what it was. Swingin' Seniors. What was it? Anyway, I like this idea very much. I'm getting back to the more serious side of things, though, Michael. Not that this isn't serious. Let's do this. Let's make it a transition by saying this. We're all expressing how there were things inside of us that didn't get, in my case, I describe it as not getting even recognized, much less nurtured. But it's always there. I have, like, almost perfect pitch. You know, I love harmony. I love doing things with other people. It's never about me alone. It's always in a group. If I ever hear music live, I want to be on that stage. That's how I feel, you know. I just want to go up on the stage too, you know, and be a part of it. This is something that gets killed in us as children, and we can relearn, you know, rekindle as adults. And a lot of the arts are being used, and you do it too, as a healing mechanism. So that you might call it music therapy or art therapy or whatever, but it is a legitimate path. It's one of the many different legitimate paths, and we list about 15 or more of different styles of recovery that are possible for adults. And they should, you know, anyone who has a kind of a creative sense of themselves, it could be writing, it could be painting, it could be poetry, it could be music, it could be, you know, sculpture, whatever it is. That's a legitimate path towards learning more about yourself and fulfilling yourself.
I agree. And there's one thing I always say in small groups. I say it here if I present. I feel that everybody is creative in one way, shape, or form.
Oh.
And a lot of people
say,
I can't play the guitar,
yeah.
I can't paint. Well, I guarantee you there's something that you can do that I can't do. Everybody has a gift, and I think it's so important to nurture that because it's going to help with your healing. And that's part of – it's not – one of the many reasons, you know, with the surviving spirit is to show what other people are doing and to share that. But again, that caveat that you don't have to do this professionally. You just do it for yourself. Do it for the love of it. Just do it for your own joy. The healing, just, you know, gardening, you know, cooking, those things are creative. And a lot of times people forget these things. Writing, there's so many things. And down at, you know, you've been through hell and then some. We deserve to heal. So anyone listening to this, please do nurture that creative spirit that's inside of you.
Now let's talk about surviving spirit. If people want to go there with us right now, they can go to survivingspirit.com. That's the website for surviving spirit. And the subtitle for surviving spirit is healing the heart through the creative arts. So it fits right in with the theme that we're talking about right now. Why don't you show us around the website a little bit while we have it up in front of ourselves? There are numerous things on the front page, but then there are some buttons that take us to different places inside the site. And why don't you tell us some of the highlights of what we'll find when we go to survivingspirit.com?
Well, when you go onto the site, and it was a work of love put into it. It was an idea that I've had for years, and then I connected with some dear friends and like-minded individuals, created a board.
And if you visit the site, and you'll see right at the top, Surviving Spirit, Healing the Heart Through the Creative Arts, then you see the Hope, Healing, and Help, because that's always been like a tagline of mine. I believe in that, Hope, Healing, and Help. But my dear friend Barbara, who is now passed in this life, she was a gifted musician, singer, songwriter, incredible pianist, keyboardist, and I had the good fortune in my business days to represent her, but she had to deal with some health issues which eventually took her life. And she also knew child abuse. And she was, so she created that, so that's there, the art piece of it. Again, it stemmed from many years ago when I first started learning how to use an email and putting together stuff. I long wanted to share what other people were doing. So I created this little newsletter, and again, I was learning as I went along, and I was just sending out an email form. And I called it Survivor Friends and Friends of Survivors. And one of the key pieces to it was sharing, if someone just wrote a book, they just created a piece of art, maybe they had an art exhibit, or the fellow advocates, if they were doing something, if they were singing, they've got a band, anything and everything that was creative, and then sharing. So that was going on for years. But always in the back of my mind was, damn, it would be great if we could have a nonprofit, because you were talking about family and stuff. I learned family, if you will, from being in a band. And I learned the band in England was a great band because we were four different unique individuals, but we're all working for the same cause. And that helped get where we were. So I thought, well, geez, what if we could find like-minded individuals to create an organization? Because I don't have all the answers or anything. And I'm the first, I know I don't. I have some good ideas. I can do certain things. But again, I like working with a band or a team. So, and I'd be traveling the country as an advocate, as a presenter, as a performer, and I'm just meeting all these wonderful creative people sharing their pieces of art, their lyrics, their painting, their songs, and I just said, there needs to be an outlet for this. So that was part of what helped drive the Surviving Spirit to be formed. So then I did finally set about to create a nonprofit. The idea and the dream is a great thing, but, creating a nonprofit, it's a business, and it's a tough sell. So we have a newsletter that has a subscription list of several thousand. I know it reaches tens of thousands because other people share it on their listserv or they post it on their website. It goes to different countries. It goes all over the U.S. And so in that respect, we're doing good. We also have a web store. We try to share what other people are doing. It's still a work in progress. It's nowhere near where we'd like it to be, but it is helping spread the word that there is healing. And at the end of the day, it's to share that there's hope, healing, and help. So now I'm going to step off the soapbox from it and let you folks ask some questions or add some conjecture.
Well, I also want to add that you do more than that. You have a speakers bureau. You know, you have the newsletter itself is something I would definitely recommend. I've been on the newsletter for a couple of years now, I guess. You have a resource page on the website. So you are doing a little more than your run of the mill simple website here. And you are a nonprofit now. You're a 501c3, right?
Correct. And you're right. We do. That's the key is the newsletter sharing resources and quotes, but also the resources that we post to the website. And there's more to add. There's more to add to the website. So you're right. We do have a speakers bureau. We do help people into different situations. Yes.
Right. And I just want to get all those things mentioned before we move on to hearing from the panel, because they're all important parts of what we're talking about here tonight. And we're gonna switch gears after we go around this set of panel, because I know there's a topic that is near to your heart that we want to get to, and it's actually being asked about in the chat room, because I mentioned it in the description of tonight's show too. Your experience with suicide and the experience of people around you, which we're going to talk about in the next segment, Lynn Tolson. Lynn Tolson is listening in the chat room. And we're going to talk about that in the next segment. So let me get some comments about what people have heard, and then we'll get to that in just a moment. All right, Michael?
Absolutely.
So we will do it in the same order that we've been doing, which means Carol Levine. Carol, you're back on with our special guest, Michael Skinner.
Yeah, Michael, I'm looking here on the resources, and you actually offer a lot. Yeah, there's a lot of things here. And also with the creative arts. If I didn't have my music when I was growing up especially, I think I would have gone nuts. And I was nuts. I was bad enough as it was. I did play the piano, and I played by ear. I started playing when I was four. And I didn't play chopsticks. Anything I could hear, I would play. And I would play like today. If I hear Cats, I can sit down and immediately play it. I listen to it, and I go and play. God gave me that gift. And with singing, you know, it was just such a release, you know, to have this musical ability to be able to sing. And I just felt so much better after I go out, and I was in bands as well. I was in quite a few bands, actually. And then, but another thing, another part of my side, too, is I was also very athletic. So if I wasn't, you know, singing or playing the piano, I would go out and run. And I was on, in high school, I was on the, you know, the teams, and I'd run around the football field, you know, and jump the hurdles. It made me, I had to get rid of that anger. I was so filled with anger, so filled with hate, and justifiably so, okay? You have a sibling that can't keep his hands off, you have parents that are mean to you, and you've already been sexually abused before, you've been kidnapped and raped. How much can a kid take? You can't take too much more, you just can't. And you're told to go ahead and commit suicide, and you want to commit suicide, and yet you don't want to commit suicide. It was just like a jumbled mess. So to have the outlets of music, or to be able to go out and run, and we always had a lot of properties, so I'd go out and run, it helped me. So I understand where you're coming from. You know, I understand that. And that's the only time maybe I would feel peace, you know, is to find peace. So
okay.
I just want to hear more of what you have to say.
All right. Let's get Lillian's comment on what she's heard in the last segment about the Surviving Spirit website and so forth. Lillian, you're back on with Michael Skinner.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm actually signed up to Mike on Twitter, and I think I got his newsletter. He sent it to me the other day as well, so I had a good read through that. And I think it's something that we should try and even promote a bit more, maybe on the page. If when you have it out, Mike, let us know and we can share it on the Facebook page so that everybody can see it there. Because it is something that so many can actually gain from. You know, there's so much you've gone through and there's so much in your newsletters. Carol just said there about music and getting peace from it. And that's something that I think some people really do. I know one of my sons gets total peace from music. If I hear opera screaming from the room, I know that he needs to be left alone. If I hear Bob Marley, I know a different mood. But I think music helps so many people because it basically, it lets you be who you want to be rather than who you have to be in life. And I just want to hear the rest of your story.
Okay. We're gonna talk about an important theme to Michael in just a moment, but let's conclude our couple more comments on the Surviving Spirit website and the work that you do there. MJ, you're back on with Michael.
Yeah, hi again. You know, we're all talking about music and the talents that people have. You know, it goes beyond that. The creativity that people have, especially people in pain, I mean, it can come out in art. It can come out in so many different ways, and it is a form of release, you know, or escape, you know. For many, many people. We've seen that in a lot of instances, but I don't want to hang on because I want to get into the suicide thing and see what you have to say about that, Michael.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks, MJ. And a final thought from Ed as far as going up finishing the panel spots for this round. Ed, you're back on with Michael Skinner.
Oh, I'm looking forward to hearing some of this, too. There's so much, Mike's involved in so much, I'm still trying to catch up with all of it. So I'm just going to let him keep talking.
All right. Well, we do have an important topic, Ed, that we don't want to cover too quickly and give you plenty of time, Michael, to talk about this because I know it's an important subject in your life and in your family's life and your own experience. You, and it's part of the description of tonight's show, are also now an author, at least of a chapter's worth, of a published book, Our Encounters with Suicide, and I provide the link to the book on the website, on the description of the show, so people can all find it. It was published in the UK, but your chapter that you wrote for the book is called The Silence of Suicide. And I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk to us about this because this is, like I say, personally important to you and something you've recently done. And that's the kind of thing we want you to be able to come back to talk to us about. And any special guest who is a member of our family could, for example, request a date when they could lead the discussion on a topic. the silence of suicide could be a topic. So let's ask you to describe what your chapter is about and how, why is it so important, the subject of suicide, to you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier in the start of the show, I've lost two of my brothers to suicide, lost two friends to suicide. I share in the book some childhood recollections of others' suicide attempt. But again, it was silence around it, but all I know is, you know, she had almost died because I could overhear people talking about loss of blood, almost died, and then she came home from the hospital after 7 days. Wrists were all fully bandaged up. The book, Our Encounters with Suicide, is powerful, poignant, and it needs to be read. And I was very fortunate and humbled and honored that I was asked to submit a chapter, again, through friends of mine who know me through my advocacy and stuff. And it's actually the third book I've had something in. I had something published in Japan several years ago and something else in the U.K. My next endeavor is to have my own book. So, again, I'm honored because there's so many wonderful people out there with equally important stories. So to have this chance to do this was awful. And my thing when writing the chapter is I'm sharing about the loss of my brothers, my two friends, my mother's attempt, but I'd be remiss if I didn't talk about my own attempts at my life. And I had three serious attempts, intent to take my life. And the fact that I'm sitting here being able to talk with you folks is indeed a miracle. I am spiritual. I don't know what I prayed. I do believe in something higher than me. I don't know what it is, and that's okay. I'm deeply spiritual. I do believe a miracle took place because I'm here, because for all intents and purposes, I couldn't be. So something bigger than me kept me here. So I wrote this chapter, and that's what I dealt with. I shared what caused me to bring me to those that darkness. So, and in writing the book, the chapter, I wanted to raise awareness. I want to create discussion concerning suicide because I thought long and hard on this. I just, you know, we all want to be heard. We all want to tell our story. But I wanted, you know, when I say the silence of suicide, I want us to get talking about it. You know, break down the fears, the misconceptions, the stigma, the discrimination. You know, dialogue around the misunderstanding and the assigning of blame with suicide. I mean, people are blaming the people in so much pain. That's why they're doing this. It's not that they're a coward. It seems like it's the easy way out. You know, the denial. Why can't we talk about suicide? Why can't we share feelings of sadness, grief, and loss? You know, what are the causalities of suicide? You know, and then, you know, my chapter, I wanted to address the trauma, abuse, and mental health challenges so many of us deal with, and how can we help those who are depressed and suicidal? And to the end of the, again, my three-legged stool that hope, healing, and health is available. So that's what went into my writing this chapter. And I recently shared, I did a presentation workshop on this. I read it at a conference I was performing at, and I did a workshop, and I had over 100 people in the room. And I read my chapter, and there's a song in there called Follow the Light, and I played the song, and then later on I played the song Joy, which is my way of giving thanks to being alive,
right,
and I'm not dead.
Right.
And I read my chapter, then I opened it up for discussion, and I tell you, it was powerful because what people were sharing, we need to be talking about this. So that's the basis of how the book came about, why I became part of it, and again, honored to be a part of it. And then now I'll let you folks ask your questions.
Well, it's an amazing phenomenon, and I agree. Not only, you know, suicide as a specific topic, but mental health as a general topic is something we seem to be really scared to talk about and keep in the background way too much, and it needs to be brought out into the light. And so suicide is part of that. But the fact of the matter is we've cut way back on our support of people who do suffer, you know, deep depressions and other kinds of mental problems. And it's an astonishing number of people who actually succeed in committing suicide, which sometimes I've heard described as a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I don't know if that makes sense to you, Michael, but I've heard it said that way. That's very simplistic, of course, because in the middle of the depression, and I obviously did not commit suicide, but I was depressed, and I still get depressed on occasion, but I get depressed for a couple hours or a couple of days nowadays, not for a couple of decades at a time, you know, and that's how it used to be. And the depression was so deep, I was immobilized by it, basically. I was that kind of person that just stayed in his apartment and covered up, you know, in the bed, and with covers pulled over my bed. And I couldn't stand anything about the world for a while. For a couple of years, I did that, I guess, in my 20s. And fortunately, you know, I didn't turn to suicide. But others on the panel have had suicide experiences. We all hear regularly about even kids that commit suicide from some of the pressures of things like bullying, you know, that are going on. And it's so sad that we're not able to talk about it more, because it is a real issue. And, you know, let's say the ultimate expression of child abuse is a homicide, which suicide is a type of homicide, you know, is death, you know. And unfortunately, we lose at least 5 kids a day, every day in our country, to some version of child abuse, you know. And a lot of it is neglect, but some number of them commit suicide, self-homicide, so suicide, and because we haven't reached them, mostly. All right, let's get the panel involved here. I know Carol's had some suicidal experiences, and we want to make sure people understand. We have 10 minutes left, so I do want to make sure everybody gets at least an opportunity to comment. Carol, you're back on first, though, with Michael.
Michael, yeah. Suicide, that's a horrible thing, you know, and yet it's something that we contemplate when we are so down low. The time that I tried to commit suicide, my mother was standing over me because I was, you know, slitting my wrist. And she said to me, do it right. Make sure you do it right. And there was a friend of mine in the room. She pulled me by my long blonde hair. It was blonde at that time. And she got me off the bed because I was laying on a bed and I was trying to cut my wrist, you know, really hard with a piece of glass. And, of course, blood was flying. We got out of there and she pulled me down the steps. She bandaged me up. But that was only a temporary fix, because for years I contemplated suicide. When you're told day after day that you're stupid, you're ugly, you're this, you're that, you're, oh, my God, you're not smart. You're not smart, okay? You'll never amount to anything. You know, I can't be your friend. You can't be my friend because we're too different. That's why my mother used to speak to me. And she never told me she loved me. And I would try at times to say I love you, and she'd never answer me back. So there was no bonding, only just criticism and being told nasty things. That, again, it seems to hurt even more than the things that we went through elsewise in our life, you know, the other abuses from strangers, you know, the kidnappings and so forth. And then, of course, having a sibling that, too, was determined to make me his playground. No help. And they knew that I had all this musical ability, and they didn't care, you know.
Let's get to the point. The point is that there's a loss of hope.
Yeah, but
a complete loss of hope.
Okay, I'm done.
Well, we got to include everybody, Carol. Go ahead.
All right. Well, I think I'm feeling a little bit emotional right now. So I'll just say this much. When you go through all that stuff, yes, you think about suicide, and it's something that you think about a lot. And I'm just thankful to God that I didn't do it. That's all. I'm done.
Well, there you go. Exactly. And we can say that because we're on the other side of it. But the people that are experiencing that depth of depression, you know, there's a deprivation of hope. There's no hope left. And a child, unfortunately, doesn't have the sense that, you know, there is a future. For the child, everything is in the moment. And there is, you know, and there's no escape. And that is also true of people who suffer mental illnesses, who have lost the ability to hope, that they feel there's no escape. And it's very sad. Let's get everybody an opportunity to talk about this. And as Lynn says, it is hard to talk about suicide without having an emotional reaction to it, obviously. Lorleen, a comment about suicide?
Yeah, I think suicide is, when you get that low, it's your only option. You feel that you've no way out. It's either suicide or you continue to live that life of abuse.
Right.
As I said, I didn't live childhood abuse. I lived domestic violence, and I did try many times. Thankfully, it didn't work. But I do think that far too many children are committing suicide, and we need to be there for the children more and let them know that there is a way out. And even if they're at rock bottom, they can still come back up again.
Mm-hmm. Well, amen to that. our panelist MJ has seen a bunch of suicides, successful suicides, come through her emergency room over the career she's had. A comment on suicide, MJ?
No, I was just thinking, you know, tragically, just like abuse, I don't think there's anybody among us that hasn't in some way been touched by suicide.
Right.
You know, it's either happened in our family or we have somebody close, you know, that's been touched by it. I mean, it's tragic. It happens all the time.
Right. Ed, a final thought from you about suicide?
Well, I know, like most people here, I've been touched by it. I've had friends that has happened to and friends who have tried it. Some people would say I've tried it, but I've never actively tried it. What I would say, I've never tried to kill myself. I just tried not to stay alive, you know. And that's a real, I don't know. Maybe that's a different distinction. Maybe it's not. But, you know, looking back on it, knowing what I know now, it was definitely a cry for help. But, you know, nobody was listening. But, you know, I don't know if taking a bottle of pills or, you know, I don't know if that's the same as walking into the middle of a big fight that you probably shouldn't win or not, but it just comes down to not really having regard for yourself, you know, and, you know, I've definitely walked that road as well.
I feel a little bit, Ed, like I didn't leave enough time to talk about this topic, and this is an example, Michael, of a topic we would love to have you come back and just do a whole show on the topic. You know, and you can lead the show. I mean, you bring materials, perhaps invite a couple of people who you know to call in and so forth. And we would love to offer this kind of thing to any of our family of special guests. And to you, Michael, this would be a good example of a show that, you know, I unfortunately didn't leave enough time maybe to really get into the topic, but maybe by way of offering you an opportunity, we can do a whole show on it someday in the near future.
I agree. And please don't apologize on that, because so many things we're discussing and covering, you know, it's hard to cover everything, but I'm glad we did touch upon it, because it is a big thing. And something that I'll just throw out real quickly is, one of the things that I came to learn in my suicide intent and TEPS was the medication that I was on, massive amounts of it, overprescribed, too many, that was just clouding my already stinking thinking. So I still get depressed. I still have, you know, thoughts of suicide, but I'm no longer on those meds, so I'm not being active. That said, I am not telling people to stop taking their meds, because some people benefit from their medication. It's just when you're overprescribed, or some of us have toxic reactions to some of these things, it has to be paid better attention, especially when we're down and out and we've already got all these traumas that are kicking the crap out of us. So, but I would definitely, I'd come back and we could talk some more. I could read the chapter, or we could just discuss more. So, yeah, I'm open to that.
Well, I want Carol's a little upset with herself for being emotional. This is an emotional topic, you know, and it's inescapable that it's an emotional topic. I wasn't telling her not to be emotional about it. I was warning her that we were running out of showtime, and maybe I was a little abrupt in doing so. So, Carol, I'm sorry if it has felt too personal. But, you know, this is, we need to devote a whole show to this. I'm convinced. This is a topic, you know, that, and I would invite you to put the topic together, Michael, and lead the discussion, and we'll all be there too, you know. But we do, about 3 out of 5 of our shows are scheduled special guest shows, and the other 2, therefore, during the week are open, we call them open topic. But there's no reason we can't make them a topic-driven show, a specific topic, and invite people like yourself to bring topics to us, and a couple of people who can you know, help present the topic, and we'll have a discussion on that topic the whole 90 minutes. And we would love to do that, Michael. So.
I'll stay in touch with you and Lurleen on
yes.
this. So, absolutely.
Yes,
I'll
and Lurleen.
Hiya.
All right. Well, Lurleen is helping to schedule all these shows, so she'd be the perfect person to coordinate this with. And we'll just make it a date. We're saying right now we're committed to a show on Michael's topic on the silence of suicide, or perhaps we could talk about some of the other, you know, mental illness problems in our country too. But that would be the central issue of the whole show, and we're making a commitment to give Michael the time to do that. Michael Skinner, thank you so much for spending the 90 minutes with us again, but you don't do it often enough.
Well, thanks. Well, I was surprised. I'm thinking, how am I going to – I'm going to be boring after, you know, after a half hour. But I can't believe 90 minutes has flown. No, I'm honored. I'm grateful that you folks had me and asked me, and it's nice talking with all of you. And, yeah, we'll definitely do more of this. And, you know, let's definitely do something on the silence of suicide. There's too many people
right.
for
Exactly. There's so much pain around that topic. They just make it a topic of itself. Michael Skinner from New Hampshire. Couldn't get it out. look him up at survivingspirit.com. Also, his own personal musical website, which is at Mike Skinner. Oh no, mskinnermusic.com. There we go. Got it out. And of course, the book title that I mentioned before was Our Encounters with Suicide. It's out of the United Kingdom. There is a link to the book, and Michael's chapter in the book is called The Silence of Suicide. And also his YouTube channel, which is at youtube.com/MCSTRAIN, McStrain, MCSTRAIN. That's the channel where you'll find many of the songs that we were mentioned tonight and others. And we thoroughly enjoy Michael, having you as a family member and relying on you to come back in the future and just, you know, to engage with us in any way that you see fit. This is Bill Murray for the whole gang saying, okay, good. This is Bill Murray saying that we won't have a show tomorrow. That's the one night a week we do not have a show, Saturday night. But we'll be back Sunday night with our News of the Week show, and then we have three special guests next week. You won't be disappointed if you tune in, or if you make time to listen the following day to the shows, which are all recorded and on demand, available the next day. If you can't make it at 8 o'clock Eastern and 5 o'clock Pacific, you can always do that. And all these shows with special guests and special topics go into a category of archive shows that we call recommended episodes. So they're easy to find. Michael's show, it will be there within about an hour of the end of the recording. It'll be available in its on-demand version, less than that, actually. And we are very appreciative of him and all the volunteers and people that have put on shows in the past week. And we hope that you'll enjoy your day off, but come back with us Sunday night, 8 o'clock Eastern. This is Bill for the whole gang saying, may God bless you, God bless America, and God bless adult survivors of child abuse.
Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.